County Reentry Council.
Kim Travis with Oregon Housing and Community Services.
I'm Bob Kelly, Assistant Director of Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute for Apprenticeship and Training.
Oh, I'm sorry, I had to step out of the room. Jackie Winter, State Senator, District 10, and it represents South Salem, West Salem, Monmouth, Independence, Almsville, and Turner. And one of the individuals who assisted in getting this legislation through so that we could have all these hearings. And I also work with Mike Schmidt on justice reinvestment. And one of the members who served to help get Senate Bill 3194 passed that gives us now some opportunities to talk about some of the reforms that we're looking at. So,
great. Reps, you want to introduce yourselves?
Go ahead, Julie.
Okay, hey, so sorry, I'm on the road trying to get back to the next place where I can get my laptop. Julie Parrish. I represent Westland and Tualatin in the legislature, House District 37, and really appreciate everybody being in the room today. Can't quite hear you yet, but I'll be there soon. But just really appreciate the work that people are coming together to do, and I'm committed to the work as well. So thanks for being in the room today.
Okay, great. Thanks, Julie. Lou?
And I'm Lou Frederick, State Representative, District 43. That's Lloyd Center North and Northeast Portland, and I'm interested in hearing from the folks who are in the room about what's going on there. So thank you.
Great. And Eddie?
Yes, my name is Eddie Alves. I'm the Vice President of Academic Affairs at Treasure Valley Community College. I apologize for not being able to get over there today.
It's not a hip, hop and a skip for you, but thank you, Eddie, for calling in. And I'm Michael Dembro. I am the other half of the duo that brought this legislation forward. You know, this, and I represent Northeast and Southeast Portland in the Oregon Senate. I chair the Committee on Workforce, and this committee really had its genesis in the Ban the Box legislation that we passed last year, which was an important step for this state to take, and very proud of what we did. But it was very clear to us, and, you know, I have to say that it was Senator Winters who first had this idea. Well, it's great that we're dealing with employment in this way, but that's not the only barrier that people are facing in having successful reentry. And we have to look at the full gamut of the obstacles that people are facing, and we need to address them. And, you know, if it's a function of the way the state law is set up, we have to look at changes that can be made. So, you know, we have this task force that was created, and we have people representing, you know, really a number of interests. County, we have, she can't be here today, but the HR director for Dave's Killer Bread is a part of this group. Just a lot of people who are really committed to getting rid of things that don't need to be there. So really happy to have you here. We have items on the agenda, and you know, there will be opportunities if you want to pipe in and give us your perspective on any of these. And then we have some time reserved at the end that we hope we'll have time at the end to hear if you have any additional thoughts that you think we should you'd like us to hear. Okay. All right, so our first item has to do, and let me just say that the way that we've set up this task force, we've kind of started looking at issues during the incarceration period. And then, you know, we're gradually moving out to, you know, that transitional period, you know, when inmates are towards the end of their sentence and are about to transition out, and then once the transition has happened, making sure that things are successful. Okay, so we are going to talk in first about a program that will be taking place within the institution, but we hope will be giving inmates the skills to be successful once they get out. So I'll turn it over. Just so happens we have a resident expert on this subject, our own Jen Netherwood. So, Jen, take it away.
Thank you, Senator Dembrow. Just first quickly, my own pathway into this system was, I'm a carpenter, so you might be wondering how I ended up working in corrections. I was unemployed and was hired to teach a pre-apprenticeship program at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility.
If you could get closer to the mic, that would help, please.
Sorry. The program ran inside the prison for 8 months, and then it was cut. And so I started on a pathway.
Lou, can you get on a computer, by the way? If you can, you'll be able to hear a lot better.
How's that?
Oh, you're in the airport. Okay.
Is that better? Can you hear me?
Yeah, go to a bar and turn the TV. Sorry.
I can hear you just fine now, baby.
Okay. At any rate, that's what started me on a pathway to advocate to bring pre-apprenticeship training back into our correctional facilities. Vocational programs inside our correctional facilities, in my mind, need to focus on two things. They need to align training with jobs that are in high demand and offer livable wages. They also need to focus on jobs that people returning from incarceration can reasonably compete for. The construction trades training programs provide pathways to jobs that meet both of these needs. The construction industry in Oregon is in an expansion period, and if you spent any time downtown trying to find a parking place, there was probably a tower crane in your way, so you know this. All of the major contractors that are employing our carpenters right now are booked out solid through the year 2018. Construction jobs, especially union construction jobs, are high wage. Journey level carpenters in Oregon right now make $34.76 an hour, plus a $14.80 fringe benefit package for a total package of $49.60. They're also high skill. To become a journey level carpenter, an apprentice completes a 4-year or 8,000 hour training program. Construction industry jobs are really better defined as family wage careers. If we invest in construction training programs inside our correctional facilities, we are preparing inmates to return to society not just ready for a job, but for a career that has the potential to be life-changing. A career with the opportunity to move beyond the journey worker level into leadership roles on the job site as foreman and superintendents. One of our contractors' biggest demands right now is for foreman and journey level workers. In fact, these contractors could grow if they could find qualified foreman to run jobs for them. And a foreman A scale is 38.24 plus the 14.84 for a total package of 53.08. So I know at this point you're all thinking, how can I become a carpenter? Well, I will tell you. The pathway to a journey level wage in the construction industry begins with apprenticeship. Apprenticeship is paid on the job learning. Once apprentices complete the application process and are dispatched to a job, they immediately start to earn a paycheck. And a first-term carpenter's wage in Oregon right now is $17.38 plus that benefits package. That wage increases every 6 months if they've completed on-the-job training and their class hours. Although the industry is expanding and construction trade apprenticeship programs are accepting apprentices at much higher rates, the application process is still incredibly competitive and candidates need to be qualified and prepared. One of the most direct routes into apprenticeship, especially for underrepresented populations such as women, people of color, and people returning from incarceration, is through the completion of a registered pre-apprenticeship program. And pre-apprenticeship programs are recognized by the industry and provide a direct pathway to registered apprenticeship. Registered pre-apprenticeship programs must be certified by the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council, and they have to meet standards that are set by the Bureau of Labor and Industry. And a couple of successful programs that are running on the outside right now are Oregon Tradeswomen, and they serve women and Constructing Hope. And traditionally, they have served people returning after incarceration, but now they are open to men and women from any background. These programs provide soft skill training, hands-on training, and trade exploration. Although there are currently no formal articulation agreements between these pre-apprenticeship programs and the apprenticeship programs in Oregon, most apprenticeships regularly recruit applicants from these programs because they're qualified. The carpenters and electricians have even started our own trade-specific pre-apprenticeship programs to try to attract diverse populations. Completion of our trade-specific pre-apprenticeship programs does lead to direct entry into our apprenticeship program. We currently have a women's program running at our facility right now. We have 11 students in that program, 9 of whom we recruited right out of the Oregon Tradeswomen program. If these women complete the program in good standing, they will get direct entry into our apprenticeship program. Apprenticeships know that partnerships with pre-apprenticeship programs are producing qualified candidates that meet their desire to diversify the workforce. In Oregon, there are currently no certified pre-apprenticeship programs being offered in any of our correctional facilities. A few things we do offer. For Eddie, we at the Snake River Correctional Facility in Eastern Oregon, we have a fantastic building construction technology program. This is a work-based education program that is administered by the Treasure Valley Community College. At OSP, we have wood and metal shops that inmates are working in through Oregon Corrections Enterprises. Most institutions have inmates working in facilities management, carpenters, plumbers, painters. This training could be recognized by apprenticeship programs, but inmates need better direction on how to translate their experience into apprenticeship applications. Coffee Creek offers a welding certification and a basic maintenance electrician program through the facilities management. Women are completing the welding programs, but very few of them are completing this basic maintenance electrician program. That welding cert can lead to manufacturing jobs, but when it's paired with a pre-apprenticeship program, it can boost their apprenticeship application tremendously, because with a welding cert and going through a pre-apprenticeship program to the carpenters, that is a more employable person. The expectation for inmates to enter into the workforce quickly upon parole is the most compelling reason to establish training programs inside of our facilities. By offering inmates the chance to earn a BOLI certified pre-apprenticeship certificate while they are still incarcerated, we are setting them up to enter a construction trade apprenticeship much faster once they parole. Pre-apprenticeship programs are consistently the most common route for women entering the trades. The biggest barrier right now for women entering the trades is actually perception. A lot of women just do not think that they can do this job, nor that they can get this job. And in fact, my own pathway started when I completed the pre-apprenticeship program with Oregon Tradeswomen, applied to the carpenters, and got in. The only example that I could find of a registered pre-apprenticeship program operating inside a correctional facility, in a women's correctional facility in our entire country, was the TRAC program. And TRAC stands, everybody needs a good acronym, but TRAC stands for Trades Related Apprenticeship Coaching. And this is a program that's running at the Washington Women's Correctional Facility in Gig Harbor. The program operates under the Washington Prison Industry umbrella and has financial buy-in from the DOC. TRAC's most important partnerships are with the apprenticeship programs for the carpenters, the iron workers, and the laborers. And in the last 4 years, 55 women have completed the program, 49 have paroled, 16 are actively employed with either the carpenters, the laborers, or the iron workers, and only 3 have come back into incarceration. The program has been so successful for them that they're actually looking to expand it to their Mission Creek facility as well. They're looking for an instructor, so I might be moving to Washington. Just kidding. That's my boss.
Let's pause a minute and let's talk about the program in Washington. When did they start it?
About 12 years ago.
Because Washington, in some of their changes, have been somewhat ahead of us for some time.
Yeah.
Well, career tech in general, they're ahead of us.
Well, not only that, some of the other things, because I...
With judicial, the
Well, you know, even the relationship, and I'm going to go back a bit, but when I was in Children's Services Division and the ability for women to actually have their children and have, you know, better visitations and what have you, Washington was way ahead of us then, and I'm talking about in the early 70s. So it's not surprising to me that they have bought into a tech program, and I think it's something that we can really learn a lot from. And the bigger one, and I think we need to learn it from Washington, is what buy-in did they get from the union? Because if we don't have that buy-in, and how engaged are the trades? If the Trade Council and others are not a parcel of this, then you run into the ability to actually get not only the instruction inside, but getting the jobs when they're coming out. So,
and that is the key, and that track program has had that solid relationship with those three trades since it started. And that's the direction we want to go here as well.
So how much is Boley involved in the conversation?
To this point, they've been involved only in the sense that they certified the CREW program, which is what I'll talk about next.
Why don't you carry on? Certainly, that's what we really want to talk about, how we can better make these certified license programs.
Okay.
With transferable credentials.
Right. Yeah. So for the last 3 years, I've been building and advocating for a program called CREW, another acronym, Construction-Related Employment for Women. And this is a Boley-certified pre-apprenticeship program that would be administered by Portland Community College and operate as a work-based education program at the Coffee Creek facility. It's a similar model to the BCT program at Snake River, but this one is a certified pre-apprenticeship program. And I'm proud to say, although I say it with a grain of salt because this is the DOC, that it looks like CREW is set to come online in the fall of 2016. And it's really not surprising that this milestone of having the second certified pre-apprenticeship program in a women's correctional facility would be in Oregon. We're a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of employing women in the trades. We sit at about 7% right now, and the national average is about 2.9%. And this is greatly due to the efforts from Oregon tradeswomen. So we've already seen that these programs can be successful in getting underrepresented populations into these high-paying jobs. Many trades within the construction industry are actively looking to diversify their workforces by recruiting women and people of color. Apprenticeship programs are actively searching for new avenues to recruit qualified female candidates because the pool of diverse applicants is relatively small. All of these apprenticeship programs are competing for the same candidates. And this goes to what you said, Senator Winters, in terms of getting buy-in from the apprenticeships. This is the time. They are actively recruiting. In fact, the Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute, we are already talking about, if CREW goes, we're already talking about the specific ways that we can partner with that program. And one of the ways that we're looking at is to bring our trade-specific pre-apprenticeship program to run inside conjunction with CREW, because if they complete our trade-specific program, they will get direct entry into the carpenters. We're also exploring possible partnerships with the Launder Learning Center in Multnomah County so that we can start working with the jail system as well. And although the construction industry has been consistently felon-friendly in their hiring practices, there's still barriers to that employment. Even if we can get them a pre-apprenticeship program on the inside, there are still some major barriers that we need to overcome in order to make these programs successful. And there's three specific things that I want to touch on that I think would make the greatest impact to having these programs be successful. And this won't be a surprise, none of this will be a surprise to anyone, but the number one barrier in obtaining a job in the construction industry for people returning after incarceration is that they often can't get a driver's license. Yeah. I It's not a surprise. But if you think about it, the driver's license and a reliable form of transportation are absolutely critical to getting a job in the construction industry because of the changing job sites. I'm not going to the same place every day. I can't get on the bus. If I don't have a driver's license and a car and I can't get to the job, I simply can't get a job in construction and make $49.60 an hour, which will take care of myself and my family. We have legislation right now for a provisional driver's license if folks enroll in a pre-apprenticeship program. The problem with this is that pre-apprenticeship programs are short. Oregon Tradeswomen's program is 7 weeks and Constructing Hope's is 9 weeks. So a very good first step would be to create legislation for a provisional driver's license that would someone could get if they are entering into a registered apprenticeship program, because registered apprenticeship programs are 3 to 5 year programs. But however, if we really want to create a meaningful piece of driver's license legislation, we are going to have to include ways to reduce and eliminate the fees and fines that often prevent people from attaining these their license in the first place. Even if we could get them a provisional license, if they have insurmountable fees and fines and can't afford a reliable car to get to their training classes, the provisional license is only going to go so far. And a program like Clean Slate only goes so far because it's specific to Multnomah County, and a lot of times folks have fines and fees in different counties and sometimes different states. So we have to attack this legislation from a broader scope.
And the issue from county to county will vary because the court jurisdiction, how it's set up, because we looked at it in Marion County and to look at Clean Slate and found some additional barriers because of how various all are not the same as Multnomah County when you start looking at how we actually process the fine. So, but we just mentioned Clean Slate immediately when you talked about fines.
We mentioned licenses before you mentioned licenses and Clean Slate before you mentioned it.
I'm not a rocket scientist.
No. This is clearly something we have to work on.
Other than the fees and licensing, what are you going to list all the other barriers?
I'm going to talk about a couple others.
Let me get in here for just a second so that you know Clean Slate is no more.
That's what I thought. What I was wondering.
It's been transferred from where
they're trying to figure out what they can do now, but it ended about a month and a half ago.
Jeremy.
We work very closely with Clean Slate, and there have been some very serious changes to the program, and right now it's being handled by the Metropolitan Public Defenders. It's being shifted over to them slowly but surely. But as of a couple of days ago, we've been, talking with them. So I don't know if that's going anywhere, but in my, we're being told by...
It may be shifting over, but it's certainly not shifting over either in the same numbers or in the approach that it once had.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
we're going to be dealing with a different a population within it, and it's unclear who's going to be running it, quite frankly. So... I'm still part of some discussion on how we reinstitute this particular program in one form or another. But it's not underway right now, as far as I know.
I think we put a kind of like a temporary hold on it until it gets.
Okay. All right. That's something I think we might want to come back to. I'd like to find out more about the problem there. Before you go on, Jen, just, with the issue of the driver's license, as Jen mentioned, we, a couple of years ago in 2013, passed legislation to create the provisional driver's license. And the idea there was, people come out with significant fines, which keep them from being able to get their license back. We want to get them into a position where they can earn money to start paying those fines back. And apprenticeship seems the right way to go. As a result of this legislation, if they enroll in a pre-apprenticeship program, for as long as they're in the program, they can have a provisional license, and they can retain that license as I understand it, that the intent was they could retain it as long as within 6 months of completing, they've set up a repayment schedule, a payment schedule through their employment. And so part of the idea there was, you know, this would be an incentive for people to stay in the program and successfully complete it, but then also to be on a path to repay. Now, one of the challenges that we legislators have is that we pass legislation, but we don't always know what happens next and how well it's working. And that is something that, you know, I really want us to look at and to find out how well it's working and if it's not working, what the problems are. But one that has surfaced is the one that Jen mentioned, that it's really just geared towards pre-apprenticeship programs, which are short-term, but also if we're hoping to put pre-apprenticeship into the facilities, then we have to have a next step for people once they come out. And so we may need to go back and bring the parties together and see how we can extend this to people who are actually in full apprenticeship programs when they get out. We are, I will say, also hoping to work on the issue of penalties and fines and the interest that's charged on these fines. And I know Representative Frederick has taken a first stab at that. We're going to come back to it, and I know we'll talk more about that here. So continue, please.
Something you mentioned is just the next thing to do would be to help facilitate relationships between the DOC and the apprenticeship programs. So we need to harmonize the construction training that we're already doing inside the facilities. Those things that I mentioned are providing inmates with some good skills that are transferable into the construction industry, but we need to establish direct links to the apprenticeship programs. And one of the things that we can look at is bringing the apprenticeship application process inside the facilities. Apprenticeship applications are multi-step application processes, and they include an application and interviews and checking qualifications. If we could bring that process inside the facility and get that step done, people, while they're still incarcerated, could enter onto what is called the ranked pool of eligibles, which is the first step into apprenticeship. Then from there, once they parole, then they can enter onto the eligible to go to work list. But if we can take the time that it takes to get from filling out an application to being in that ranked pool and get that done while they're still incarcerated, it'll make the process go much faster once they get out.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How much of that filling out the application can be done through, and I'm thinking now out loud, through parole and probation? Because now that we have 3194, we're reaching in through that mechanism in some cases 120 days or so before the person is released. In some cases, 90. But is that a possibility?
I guess the timing would matter most. The ranked pool of eligibles is we are taking applications from the carpenter's perspective. We're taking applications every month, and we're ranking those folks with a score of 100, 99, 98. And next month, we take in a new pool of applications, and we rank them 100, 99, 98. When RJATC says it's time to take 30 apprentices onto the out-of-work list, we start with all of the folks that scored 100%. Then 99, then 98, until we've reached our 30. So the timing, if an inmate scores 99%, but she's got 120 days left, and her number comes up, she may need to sit. So the closer we can get them to the gate when we're putting them in that ranked pool, their number could come up, they could parole, they could be to work in a week, depending on how many our JATC is saying we need to take in, and that's consistent for other trades as well. So timing of putting them through that process will matter. And pre-screening will matter as well. If they're going through a pre-apprenticeship program and they're being pre-screened for the ability to get a driver's license and they're set up to go to work, we can get them right at the gate ready to go.
But Jen, let me just ask, if they've been established, say, as a 99 or 100, and then, but they're not eligible to take a job because they're still inside, I mean, could that rank be held open to them, and then as soon as they get out, they would be next on the list?
My knee-jerk reaction would be yes, but that guy might have a better answer.
No, I think it would be, but as Jen said, the timing is if somebody's 120, ours usually takes about 30 to 45 days if you go through the whole process. One thing that's going to make it quicker is we've approached Boley and we're going to implement online registration or applications. So that's something that could be done. We could do the process. We would definitely make where the interview process is. We would send somebody over, depends where it is, or I'm involved with Snake River, and send somebody over if they have someone that wants to apply to interview them and see what they are. So it would be timing. And so if we're going to get involved and do this, yes, we would be able to.
I think I'm trying to look broadly at the collaboration piece, particularly since, you know, when we did all the work on 3194, and, you know, the one piece that says, okay, we're going to reach in and start even driver's license, even prepare the person for health care and all that before they actually get back into the community. So it seems to me that the reach-in piece into the institution, whether we're talking about Snake River or OSP or where we're talking about, would also fit in with what you're talking about in preparing the person going out. So, you know, that piece requires that coordination work with whether it is Underhill's people in Multnomah County and that, but it I don't think it's impossible. I just think that we've got to start doing some aligning. You know, because we already are talking about the driver's license piece and what's needed for that. We're talking about what can happen, and we're doing the reach-in on health care to make certain that the persons are qualified for Medicaid, that we're getting them signed up. And so by the time that they're out of that gate, that, you know, they're already registered with the Oregon Health Authority. So there are some stuff that's taking place, and I'm just seeing how we can actually, from your perspective, fit what you're doing in to make that even a part of it.
And okay. And the last thing that I want to mention is when we invest in investing in apprenticeship is one of the best investments we can make at the governmental level. If this task force could establish ways to invest money to expand programs that can provide trade-specific services to people starting their careers in the construction industry, that's kind of a final piece in terms of really making these candidates qualified and successful. There's no other pre-apprenticeship programs in the country that don't offer wraparound services for their graduates. And I know it's a little bit trickier with programs inside a facility how to support them when they leave the facility. It may not be the facility's staff that is providing those wraparound services. But there are programs such as the Oregon Department of Transportation and Boley Highway Construction Workforce Development Program, which you're probably familiar with, but it's a federally funded program that provides support services for things like tools, travel to job sites that are more than 60 miles away, and childcare for apprentices that are participating in the heavy highway trades. And those trades are carpenters, ironworkers, laborers, cement masons, operating engineers, and painters. Childcare is without a doubt the second biggest barrier to women entering the trades behind perception. The costs are high, and then the other thing is many childcare providers do not align with construction hours. And this increasingly is affecting men who are becoming single fathers as well. So if we could look at ways to increase assistance programs that have specific trade-related services and link programs like CRU and our other programs that are offering construction trades training to our incarcerated people. That time and that use of time and resources is going to make these programs, make or break these programs. That's pretty much all I have.
Okay, thank you very much, Jen. Any questions? Yes, Mike.
I think everyone in the room probably feels that that would be a good investment in programs to support. I just wanted to bring up that the CJC's partnered with DOC recently to use a cost.
Okay, so CJC?
The Criminal Justice Commission.
I know that.
Has partnered with the Department of Corrections. It's a lot of letters. It can go really quick. To implement a cost-benefit tool recently. And I just wanted to just kind of add a little bit to what Jen was saying. When we looked at the vocational programs that DOC is already implementing and then looked at how they decrease recidivism in the population that utilizes those programs, we see that for every dollar that Oregon invests in those programs, we can expect a return of $6.40 over the course of 10 years. And that's societal returns. And so that's counting the costs of not having another court case, police, victimization costs. It's not even adding in the benefits of the person, you know, getting a job and then becoming taxpayers, but just the societal cost to that reduction in recidivism. For every dollar we spend, we find that in Oregon we get $6.40 back on those types of programs.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Any other questions for Jen?
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please, please, please.
So it's like one more layer I'll add to it.
Yeah.
And so what I think is also a benefit is the work that Oregon Corrections Enterprise has done. We have a barrier. Some of the costs could be offset or even eliminated to the taxpayers if we can have less displacement concerns, so that we can provide more products and services in the community that will help support those dollars. So for instance, DOC has many of these programs like CRU, great program. If we can find an outlet to be able to sell those items that are being created, then those items can, those programs can be more self-sustaining. And so I think that's a missing link that might be helpful for this group.
The only issue that I have to that is my concern is putting an education program like CRU under a for-profit umbrella. And this has been my concern all along. And I think looking at programs like this to be self-sustaining or cost reducing is one thing. But I think that we can look at community partners to help reduce costs. I get concerned just because of the first program failed for many reasons, and one of them is because it wasn't profitable. So I worry about putting all of these programs under the for-profit side.
Well, folks, I'm gonna have to leave, I'm afraid. Thank you for the information, and I'll talk with you when I get back. Thank you.
Okay, great, Lou. Have a good flight or whatever.
Okay. So,
yes,
this is Lynn Parrish. I just want to ask a question, you know, because I had two bills this last session around driver's license and professional license. Are there any of the construction trades that we know of, because we've got a pretty high license limit threshold, like there's a lot of license requirements. Sometimes it's thousands in other states that don't require the same type of level of licensure. Are there any construction trade licenses that you are absolutely precluded from because of your felony status?
That's a good question. In Oregon, I don't believe there are. I can speak for our application process. We It's the driver's license is mainly driven by the contractors because they need a worker that can get to the job. And their application is going to be seen as a stronger application if they have that driver's license, although it may not be specifically required for the application for an apprenticeship program. They're not going to be a strong candidate if they don't have that driver's license.
And the driver's license piece, I understand, it's the, like a lot of our healthcare trades, for example, or, teacher license or things like that, where you just simply can't be a felon and actually go to the state and get the state, say a plumber's license or something. Like, you couldn't get it because it's felony is overrules you in statute. And so that's what I'm trying to, on the professional licensure side, anything that prevents somebody who's completed a program from actually walking in the door and getting the license. Because, you could have somebody who's a felon who goes to community college and takes all those classes and then gets to the sort of the finish line, if you will, shows up at the state of Oregon and says, okay, I'm ready for my license. And, and then that felony status won't actually let them be licensed in our state.
Not for the construction trades. Some of the contractors may require, like Intel, for example, they can say that they're not going to have anybody working on their job sites that's been on paper in the last 5 years. But that's few and far between. As far as actually getting the journeyman license, the felony conviction is not going to prevent them from getting that license and working in the industry. They just may not be able to be dispatched to every job with every contractor because it's based on what the owner, what the contractor wants.
Yeah, but Rep. Parrish, you ask an important question. We'll try to get an inventory of those trades if there are any that, for which this is a barrier. I know that in the community colleges, when a student enters a program, they're notified about any potential limitations, or at least they're supposed to be notified that just in order to prevent the kind of scenario that you're laying out there, that, they go through the program successfully and then can't find work because they cannot qualify, sit for the license even.
Senator Deborah.
Yes, that's the part I was worried about. So thank you for answering.
I think it would be worthwhile to have that inventory anyway, because I'm not convinced, and I could be wrong in my mind, that some of them have that requirement, and yet there's no nexus to the felony charges and what they're applying for. So it would be well for us to take a look at those anyway.
Right. And if there's a barrier, what is the source of the barrier? Is it federal? Is it state? Yeah. Is it trade specific? That's what we should find out.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Oh, go ahead. Eddie, yes, please.
I've had some experience with this, and I came from the Washington system. We had some of that challenge in the fact that we ran a heating, ventilation, air conditioning type of certification, and then we discovered after the fact that those HVAC employers didn't necessarily want to send people out with felony convictions to individual residential homes, so we had to revamp that program to make it more commercial. So I think I think you're going to run into some barriers, but I don't know if you're going to be able to create an inventory that will answer your question.
So, Senator?
Yes, Mike.
I just quickly, and I was familiar with this resource, if you go onto if you Google ABA collateral consequences, they have a website that does what you're asking, inventories for every state. You can click on Oregon. I'm on it right now on my iPad, and just, right off the top, it shows you a list of different things in our OARs or statute that you're disqualified for. For example, I was just showing Paul one of them, Oregon Administrative Rule, ineligible to serve as an employee, contractor, volunteer with Department of Administrative Services for any felony or any misdemeanor.
Would you actually, I think we need to highlight two things. He said administrative rule. There's a big difference between ORS and administrative rule, and I think it's well for us to highlight those. Mm-hmm.
Just for those of you who aren't really familiar with the system, we have our Oregon statutes, and those are the laws, and we pass those as legislators. Then after we pass those, then the different agencies implement the law that we have passed. And they do that through rules. And the rules have more flexibility. They can be changed more easily. But at the same time, they're less immediately under our control. But we can certainly influence those rules. So that's really important to know. Yeah, Serena.
Senators, I think it's another take note to note. It also depends on how old the felony was and if the employer is willing to take a chance on you, even in health care, because there are some nurses who've had some felony problems, but if they've gotten a relationship with the health care provider, they've been known. There's one particular who went through Clean Slate, and she was highlighted several years ago. And this trauma doc took her under his wing, and she's been a perfect employee, you know, since then. So it also depends on how long the felony was for, or what their crime was for, but also if someone's willing to take a chance on you. And as a previous assistant living administrator, I too did the same thing. I took a chance on an employee, and that employee is still with that organization to this date. So it also just depends on who's willing to take a chance and who's willing to support that person as well, and again, how old the crime was.
Great. Paul?
Chair Demereaux, you know, there's been quite a bit of research that's been done on the likelihood of a person committing a crime over a period of time. So once we get past a certain point, 5+ years, we know that a person is no more likely to commit another crime than a person who's never been convicted of a crime. So I think we need to keep this in mind, not just with employment, with housing, with anything where we're asking about people's criminal histories, because we have empirical evidence that shows us the risk that people present. Yet, we still have these barriers that get in the way for, in many cases, the rest of people's lives.
Very important. So, Mike, what was that website address again?
I Googled. So, actually, it's at the top here. It says www.abacollateralconsequences.org. All one word. abacollateralconsequences.org.
Okay, great. I think we'll go through that. Yeah. All right, good. Anything else for Jen before we move on?
Thank you.
Any of you in the audience who have any reaction to this? You're welcome to speak up. Okay, well, thank you. Thanks a lot, Jen. Okay, Karen, want to talk to us about career readiness certificates? Career readiness certificates are certificates that attest to a person's skills of various sorts, and it's something that the community colleges have been working on for a while, and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which I also sit on, has really been encouraging. And so I asked Karen to come to talk to us about that program and about, you know, whether it's being used in our institutions, and if not, should it be? Would it be useful?
Great. Well, thank you. And I didn't mean to be nebulous when I introduced myself earlier, but who I work for is the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, but there's a workforce investment division within that agency. We have purview over a lot of workforce development programs for adults, dislocated worker youth, focusing a lot on individuals with barriers to employment. And the National Career Readiness Certificate is one tool in our toolbox that we use. Actually, both Senators Demereaux and Winters were part of a House bill back in 2009 that sort of implemented this program and said we should. I saw your name on there. I know it's true. But it implemented we call it the NCRC. So and it's now, even though funding didn't come for another session, we actually started to explore what would a tool look like that would give sort of not necessarily industry specific, but just certify someone's skills generally with employment. And we started out this program with a variety of federal funds, and now we get some general funds to also assist. So when we talk about the National Career Readiness readiness certificate. I just want to briefly explain what that is. It is actually certification that comes from ACT, and ACT is that organization you may or may not have heard of, like the SATs and the ACT are those tests you take after you get out of high school or when you're in high school, and they're entrance exams to get into college. And so ACT decided many years ago that they wanted to find out if, kind of get out of the business of just their academia, but to talk about what are the skills that employers are looking for and how do they certify for that. So they actually went out and they profiled about 20,000 different jobs, different occupations within industry, across different industries, and said, these are sort of the things that we feel, based on that research, need to be certified in order to kind of describe someone's skills that go across industries. And they developed the certificate, and they have a sort of a way in which it relates to employer need, job seekers need, and then also educators using it in terms of getting people job ready. The thing about the NCRC I think is most important is that it's not you get into this particular industry, not for healthcare or for manufacturing only or something like that. It's really broad skills. So the test itself has three components, reading for information, applied mathematics, and locating information. And these are not your typical get nervous in high school or college kinds of, you know, if an airplane's going this far, what does it mean? These are actual applied questions. They actually have application to real jobs. In the writing or the reading, you're actually looking at memos or instructions that might be on a machine and how that connects. In the locating information, I've actually taken the test and all of them. And in locating information, there's, you know, there are places where there's circuits and they're asking you, how would this fit together based on these instructions that are sitting on the same page? And so this is really about application of skills more than it is have you read a book and can do the skills. So I think that's one thing that makes it unique. Right now, the test can be administered, just for purposes of this group, the test can be administered electronically or in paper pencil version. So I know we've not made full entree into the correction system in terms of use of this. Sometimes it has to do with technology because it is, you know, internet-based, but there is a paper pencil version, and it's currently only in English, but there is a Spanish version that's supposed to come online sometime in the fall that ACT is presenting, so I think that's important to note as well. We also offer, just sort of as a part of this complement, for lack of a better term, preparatory software. Again, this is computer-based, but we do make an investment that's actually fairly small but makes it accessible by as many number of terminals that we would like, in software that would prepare you for taking the exam and assist you with that ahead of time. When you take the test, you're certified in one of four levels. It's just like the Olympics, I guess, only platinum's even cooler. Bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. Don't need to really know much about the scores, but the percentages that are on the screen there, they really talk to how many jobs. It's like the low. So 16% of 16% of jobs that had been profiled by ACT require a bronze basic. Or I'm saying it backwards. I guess you'd subtract. So only 1% of jobs would be need a platinum for you to participate. You know, need that certification. And then 7% of all jobs at a gold. And so really, if you are at the silver or higher level, you are really covered in a vast majority of jobs, at least, that were profiled by ACT. So we sort of use that as a bit of a benchmark in terms of trying to get folks to get at least the silver or higher level. So one of the things, particularly in the world I live in, there are a couple of things that we talk about: people who have barriers to employment and also gaps in their employment history, and those become real challenges for people, I think, particularly for this task force. This is a way in which folks can document skills and have a piece of paper that they can take to an employer that they can supplement with a resume that's skill-based versus chronologically based, all of those things, and really say, even if the employer's never heard of this thing, I'll show you my certificate, which is gold and not platinum. It's kind of embarrassing, but and my kid has drawn on it. But on the back of the certificate, it actually says, okay, so if you have a gold level, I have these skills. So it's something you could take in your portfolio, show people. It looks fancy. If it hadn't been sitting in the window in my office, it's a little bit nicer. But it's signed. It's certified. You have an actual number that goes with it. And then for me, I always think one of the best things for the individual applicant is even if no one's heard of this, you can start to talk about your skills. So if you go to an interview or you're in, you know, writing your resume, you can actually start to put some of these things on there. So that's what you're highlighting versus whether there's a gap in employment or something else. So, and I think one of the most important things we've learned with the NCRC as we've implemented it statewide is that it changes dramatically how people feel about their own skill set. So when you're talking about folks who might lack confidence in their own skill set or not understand how to speak about it, they're even if it's not used for them in their job search or they don't really refer back to it, it changes the way people frame themselves and, oh, I really have all those things. That's kind of amazing. I didn't know I could do those things in a way that you speak about it. Most of us don't, you know, wake up and think about the skills we have for our work or what do we bring to the table for an employer. Obviously, it's used for a job search tool, and it is important. It's nationally recognized because of ACT being the ones who created it. There are about 40 states who actually actively utilize the National Career Readiness Certificate like we do. The other piece of this equation, obviously, is there a demand for this in business and industry? Are they looking for this? We do have some employers who actually choose to profile their jobs, like I was talking about that big bank of profiled work. There may be, like Northwest Natural is a good example. They have all of their jobs at Northwest Natural are profiled before you can even apply. As you're going through the application process, they actually ask you to take this test, and then they utilize that to help assist them in their HR processes. For employers who use this, it reduces hiring and training costs and employer turnover, so there's that piece. And again, not every business or employer knows about the certificate, but individuals can still use it as part of their portfolio. There's a third piece of the equation, which is there are most counties and many communities in this state have chosen to say we are a certified work-ready community, which really means you have a certain number of these certificates in your community. And if you want to be one of these certified work-ready communities, you have to have some youth or emerging workforce, some incumbent workers, certain percentages, and some transitioning workers, which means people either dislocated workers or people getting back into the workforce. And so those numbers then roll up into being able to say that you're work ready as a community. So there's it's kind of an additional incentive that people use for economic development. So when we talk about corrections, I think we have done very little in this area. I could find reference to the fact that we proctored 75, little 25 in each of Coffee Creek once, OSCI and San Yam Correctional Institution, sort of can we do this? And I believe those were done in paper pencil. We could increase that. There's a lot of room to talk about this in terms of funding, but just in terms of we haven't made that direct linkage beyond sort of our WorkSource Oregon and our K-12 system. K-12 uses this, and this may be another one where we could talk about it in terms of OIA or also people who are completing a credential like a GED or a diploma. Oregon has an essential skills requirement as part of the high school diploma. And one of the ways in which you can meet that essential skills requirement is to get a gold on your math and reading in the NCRC. So a lot of schools and a lot of alternative programs are using the NCRC as a way to meet that essential skills requirement. There have been some incredible statistics in terms of that working for folks instead of the traditional ways in which people are meeting the essential skills requirement. Obviously, this is applied. It makes more sense. It works for those folks. So just in terms of some statistics so you all know, we have about 55,000 certificates in the state right now. I guess I should mention, too, this certificate doesn't necessarily expire. So if it's part of your skill set, it's part of your skill set. So it's not like it doesn't have a lifetime. So that's important, too. You could potentially be taking it at any time, not necessarily like close to reentering into the community, and still it would be valid. So it doesn't have to necessarily appear at a certain time. The breakout on the left is just silver, gold, platinum's the little black one. But we do actually in Oregon have a much higher percentage of gold and higher than a lot of other states. So I don't know why we're so smart, but we are. These are two super small on screen. I'm going to just skip one. But because of the essential skills requirement, we have begun to test and certify more young people. But there's also, on this one, this is a demographics piece. This is all self-report, so we can draw whatever conclusions we want from it. But there, it kind of just shows you the breakdown of different kinds of categories of folks. We don't make these sort of the names of these things, but you can see the population that is folks from communities of color. Hispanic is broken out separately because of being the largest group. The rest go together. Ex-offenders, again, this is self-reporting, are about 8.5% of people who we currently have certified. SNAP, I think most of you are familiar with, but that's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, food stamps. And then low income, and then the gender breakdown, and then folks who have a disability. So it gives you a sense of the breadth of folks that we're talking about that receive the certification. I had another handout that I think folks at the table at least have, but it looks like this. And this is probably the most, if you, is it on the back table maybe?
That's a quick question.
Okay. Yes, please, sorry.
I noticed how you didn't do mail on this.
I think it's just the remainder.
Oh.
So, but no, there's no breakout. I have no idea why that pulled that way. Because no men test. Just kidding. Yes. I guess we can safely assume that of the 39%, so the 60% are men, but I'm not sure why it doesn't have the breakdown of the certifications. I can get that. Although you can see, generally speaking, the breakdown is pretty proportionate regardless of, you know, category. Were there other questions? Sorry, before I roar into this next piece.
African in with African Americans or?
Yes. Yeah, so teeny, you can't see, but Black African American is a category. And again, these are ACT's categories, so.
Think about the African community, because that's usually, yeah, separate. You have Black African Americans and then African, so you don't.
These are ACT's criteria, so we have to go with their, okay, how they're breaking it out, and it is not that specific, no.
Okay.
No. And no other kinds of, I mean, these are sort of the demographic questions. No other questions like native language or anything like that would be categorized either. So we're kind of limited in that statistic. Although there's some influence on what ACT collects if all the states kind of agree, so we can potentially change what's being gathered if we bring that forward. Are there other questions?
Yeah, I do have a question,
yeah,
Karen. Do we know if any other states are using the CRC within their correction systems?
I couldn't name you specific states, but yes, I know that people are utilizing this, and it really depends on funding for some. Right now, we do pay for the certificates, as you know, so that's primarily paid for through general funds. The sort of training up and pre-testing stuff is paid through federal funds, but so in some states that has to do with funding and also just access to facilities.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you could steer us towards some models,
mm-hmm,
you know, that we might want to emulate. You know, part of, you know, I know the being able to do it through paper and pencil is a good thing. I mean, that'll help. But, you know, there is a research component here, and that could create some obstacles. You know, they are looking for online experience with that kind of data search, your ability to do that kind of thing. So just to see how other states have done workarounds on that challenge.
Yep. Yeah.
Great.
What is it, 46 states that are?
The 40 other.
Of the 46 states which are reached into corrections.
And I'm not, I want to just briefly, just so people can look at this, this sheet, I'm not allowed to say that it's causal, but you can see that both the employment, the entered employment rate, the retention, and the wage gain are significantly higher for folks who have the NCRC. And while we don't know exactly why that is, it's still certainly, it could be to the confidence boosting, it could be due to the commitment of taking the test, but it's certainly, when the words PRISM employment, that's just the database of all the people in our workforce system. And so compared to all of the regular cohort, the folks who have the NCRC are faring better.
Great. Any other questions about the NCRC? I think this is something we're going to want to look at, how we can make this part of preparing inmates for transitioning out. Having this credential, I think, would be very useful.
I think, yes, and then the other thing that would come to light in this is, particularly in what we don't know with the other states, when we start talking about it, and which always comes up, and, you know, we have somewhat left the longest length of stay, I think, of some other states do. So there's a lot of factors that go into when people are ready to come out, and that gets into the skill sets or the development inside that makes the preparation ready for outside.
Okay, well, this, thanks a lot, Karen. Yeah. So this really brings us very easily into the next item where Jeremy is going to talk to us about post-release housing certificates and what are sometimes called certificates of good standing is another form.
Yeah, so I kind of structured how I was going to talk to you guys pretty casually. I am the administrator of a very specific pilot project program. But before I get into kind of what Mercy Corps Northwest has done with that program and the certificates of good standing, I kind of wanted to back up and go over sort of the national context for why we did what we did. We call ours Certificate of Good Standing, but you'll also hear them referred to as Certificates of Good Conduct, Relief, Rehab. You know, that's how they're sort of often presented. This original sort of certification came up through the Legal Action Center, which is a national nonprofit focused on, you know, all things reentry. And basically the idea was to create an add-on. So if we look at the journey of people going through the system, you know, there's being arrested, being sentenced, going to jail, releasing, and then the idea is that, you know, once you release, you've paid your sort of debt to society, you fully pay your debt to society once you're off paper, but we all know that's not true. Collateral consequences, as Mike mentioned before, sort of follow people around, stop you from finding housing, finding a job. So the idea was that this would add on something to where someone who had a felony conviction could go back to a court and ask to have a document legally drawn up that said this person has been officially rehabilitated and they should no longer sort of be held, they should no longer be punished or sort of had that, have people look at their felony conviction as sort of a part of who they are. You know, it's so completely in the past. In 2003, soon to be, or no, is it 2003? Let me make sure. But basically when Barack Obama was a state senator, he brought this to Illinois and it came about. But so, you know, it's been, you know, around 2011 is when this idea of the certificate program really kicked off. There are currently 9 states in Washington, D.C. using the certificates. They started mostly with employment, and I work in housing, but at Mercy Corps Northwest, the sort of light dinged in our eyes because employment law always typically, housing law follows employment law, and when the EEOC, which is an acronym that I cannot fully
employment opportunity.
Yeah.
So I haven't been gone that long. For
okay. they said a blanket ban on all felonies creates a disparate impact, and sort of that was in 2012. Less than a month ago, HUD issued basically the same thing for housing. So we see that logic playing out now on the national level. And basically, employment and housing laws in certain states like Hawaii and California are starting to be amended to include these certificates. They're typically run through sort of parole or probation systems or the judicial system. So they're not done. Like our program, we are a nonprofit. We are not, you know, we have contracts with the government, but, you know, the government is not involved in this certificate in any way on our end. But throughout the country, they are. And Oregon actually in 2015 tried to bring this to the state legislature. Chief Justice Paul Jimenez floated an idea for a certificate of employment. You know, it's a little bit above my pay grade to know why it didn't work, but it didn't work. We were disappointed. Mercy Corps had been involved in that. And we decided that, you know, let's try it on our own. Let's see if we can get some success to sort of show that this could really work. And, you know, I mean, I do know one of the reasons that the certificate on the legislative level didn't work is that this costs money, this costs time for courts to, you know, run it out of, you know, for them to sort of administer it. And, you know, without a fiscal note attached, it's, you know, it doesn't really fly. So
I will say we never got that proposal.
You didn't get it because it was.
I don't remember it.
Yeah. I do.
I printed it out. I didn't pass it out, but I can pass it out again. So I was not involved personally in sort of the advocacy for that. But so that kind of leads us to Mercy Corps Northwest. For those of you that don't know, Mercy Corps Northwest is a nonprofit in Portland, Oregon. We do a broad swath of things, but on the reentry side of things, we teach a class in Coffee Creek called the Life Program. And then we run the Reentry Transition Center in Multnomah County for folks that are transitioning out of jail and prison back into the community. And I like that I'm last because it highlights, you know, where we were looking at, you know, pre-apprentice programs inside, you know, the employment verification certification for right when you get out. And Mercy Corps Northwest, most of my job centers on folks that are releasing. They've only been out a month. They're new to reentry. They're just starting to transition. But the certificate program was brought about because we were seeing our most dedicated clients, ones that by any means were successful, really hitting a wall when it came to housing. You know, they were securing a job, but because of that felony conviction, they were really unsuccessful at finding, you know, housing that fit their budget, fit their needs, and was not, you know, was above standard or not substandard. And then with the market in Multnomah County that kind of going crazy on the housing front, we were having people that had sort of successfully graduated our program all of a sudden come back to us because they were getting no-cause evictions or the rent was being raised too high and they were forced to move. And all of a sudden, you know, they thought they had successfully reentered and put that past behind them, but now that felony conviction was coming back into play. So we really focused on the certificate of good standing to work with people that have been out at least 18 months. So they've had time to sort of present documented successes and really be able to prove that they're ready for the certificate. And sort of what the certificate states is that an individual, though they have a felony conviction, we believe that they are going to make an excellent tenant, an excellent community member, and have done everything in their power to lower the risk of recidivism, to lower their own personal risk. And, you know, like Paul said, if it's been over 5 years, they made it 5 years, they've done everything in their power, you know. They've proven it. So we piloted the program through a grant with Meyer Community Trust, and we recruited a panel of six sort of housing and reentry experts. I passed out a sort of a one-pager that has a little bit about the Reentry Transition Center and a little bit about the Certificate of Good Standing Program. One very important mistake that's been made is it says the panel has representatives from the Department of Community Justice. That is not true. This is an old draft. We have former employees of the Department of Community Justice. I'm very glad that Truels is not here for that. But we have six folks, two former parole officers, an A&D treatment professional, a mentor, Dave Bachman, who's the head of Cascade Management, which manages a lot of the affordable properties in Multnomah County, a resident services coordinator, and then another a staff member from VOA in their residential treatment program. So they holistically evaluate applicants to the Certificate of Good Standing program to see if they have been able to sort of successfully, we didn't like the term rehabilitation or relief, because relief has sort of some legal context and rehabilitation has some drug and alcohol context, so we chose good standing. But basically that, you know, these people have been able to prove that they, through, you know, letters of reference, completed programs, steady job history, Rentwell certificates, you know, the anything and everything that they can sort of present to our panel, that they're ready to, you know, move on with their lives. And so the idea was to then take this panel and what we were doing and really reach out to the landlords of Multnomah County and make it a tool for them. I think we, and I have been very surprised, is people want to help, especially on the landlord front, property management companies. People know, everyone knows someone who's been affected by a felony conviction. But there's a whole host of reasons why people are unable or unwilling to work with people that have a felony background. And what we were trying to do is say, we are community experts in this. We are funded by the Department of Community Justice. We've been able to compile a panel of people that are not related to Mercy Corps Northwest officially, that are willing to sort of stamp their name and their reputation on every applicant that comes through. And we want to give this as a tool to you to implement into your screening criteria. So in Multnomah County, if you have a felony conviction under 3 years, the chances of you passing screening criteria are very, very low. And the idea was, you know, you can always appeal a denial, but those denials take time. There's not a lot of knowledge around the correct processes. So we were seeing a lot of people that were failing screening criteria. So the idea was that, you know, a landlord could say, you know what, you would have failed my screening criteria, but because you hold the certificate of good standing, we're going to let you in. We're going to overturn the denial right off the bat and not make you go through the denial process. We started this project right before sort of the market went haywire. Landlords do not need to make any additions or any leniencies to their screening criteria. So that's an area where we're still struggling. But we have had a lot of luck with the appeals process and using the certificate to advocate for men and women who have done really phenomenal work and got them in to private market housing. So, and you know, the certificate comes with case management services provided by Mercy Corps Northwest. At times, it has come with some financial incentives. We're currently undergoing some funding shifts, so we're waiting on grant opportunities and all of that. Where I really see the certificate program being sort of applicable to the work we do is to sort of push it on a legislative level and then partner with folks in the community, whether they be people like Mercy Corps or sponsors, to help provide support. Because, you know, we have to be able to provide support to people as they are re-entering, not just certify them that they successfully did it. We need to be able to give them the tools to successfully do it. You know, in Chicago, that's what's happening. The legal aid office has partnered with other nonprofits to really increase people's knowledge about the ability to apply for these certificates. So I think that's something that I'd like to explore more. I am by no means an expert on sort of the legal issues around the certificate, but I think it's a conversation that we could continue on and we could bring in folks.
Jeremy, and I've got tons of questions. And as you know, I had the conversation with Judge DeMunis. But, you know, you're talking about 18 months after the person is out, and where the immediate need for housing and a place is when a person actually is released and is on the ground.
Absolutely. This program is not for
that. It's not for that.
Absolutely
not. So, you know, I think, you know, our challenge, and I was listening, trying to listen very carefully to who was a part of the group to help put this together, and my question is, and maybe we need to have a further conversation with the landlord and the renters and what have you, and ask them, you know, what is it they're actually looking for and why we're not able to crack and open those doors. Because to me, and I have begun talking locally in Marion County to our folks here, you know, what is it, if I was to put together a pre-screening tool, what is it that you're looking for? You know, what is it that will help me get somebody through your door? I can't wait until the person's been in my community 18 months, because 18 months is far too long for a person to be out there homeless on the street. You know, and if we're not able to actually get them through the quote, and I've got some real issues on this one, if we're not able to get federally, and I was glad to see that they're making some change federally, because our housing authority and those governmental entities are just as bad as the private sector.
So, and that is a good segue. Well, one, we met with local landlords, and we were told we would like for them to wait 5 years before they consider the certificate. And we said, that is, we can't have people.
That's Multnomah County.
That's private landlords in Multnomah County and public.
I have to qualify that.
Yeah, it's in Multnomah County. And so we fought for a year and a half. I wish it could be shorter. The majority of my job is dealing with people in extreme housing crises right as they release. And I will say that, yeah, this isn't a tool for those folks. I wish it was. Right now, we are working with Home Forward, which is the housing authority in Multnomah County, to pilot this project in some of their buildings to basically serve as the appeal. So they would, someone would apply for a public housing unit, normally would get denied and have to go through a fairly lengthy appeals process where they cannot hold the unit. This would circumvent that. They would take the certificate, and they would say, you know what, initially this would have been a denial. This is an automatic overturn of the denial for the certificate.
You know, Senator Jim Brose, a couple things I'd like for us to look at. And I'd like for us to bring someone in from the federal agency to have a conversation to us, and someone from the housing authority to have a conversation with us. There's some barriers that are there that are so totally ridiculous that it's even funny. Yeah. Not even funny anymore. Example. If you happen to be a felon and you want to go stay with your wife, who happens to be in a housing, you know, that's subsidized and what have you, you can't do it. And yet we sit here and talk about wanting to put families back together and what have you, and we put these barriers here. You know, if anything, these are the kinds of things that I'd like to see us to begin taking on. It's unrealistic.
Yeah.
To have those kinds of policies out there in the community. And so, you know, our governmental entities that we are part and parcel, we're part of, you know, we always talk about the private sector, but I want to zero in also on the public sector.
Absolutely.
And find out what those administratively and what those legal barriers are that maybe we on this body can have some influence or begin chipping away at. It's one that, as you everybody knows, it sends me up in orbit in dealing with some of the complaints of individuals coming out of our various institutions, and they've got a family here, and yet, by golly, I can't even go live with my own family. You know, I've got some way to have a roof over my head, but I can't access that roof.
And that's actually one of the reasons why we got initial funding, was to tackle this sort of problem of family reunification, because we were seeing a lot of people coming out. Their wives and girlfriends had Section 8 vouchers. They were unable. They put their families at risk. This program has not solved that, and I'd like to continue to push that. And I think absolutely. I think, at least from the conversations I've had with Home Forward, I know that they were interested to coming to speak here, or having a representative from the housing authorities come to speak. And I think next session next month, it would definitely be good to have them come because, there's only so much this program can do because it is just, we're just a community-based nonprofit trying to sort of go from the grassroots. So if we can go from this way and then this panel can go from that way.
Yeah, we haven't really gotten into the housing issue yet, and we absolutely need to. And we definitely, I totally agree, we need to hear from the public side. We also need to hear from some landlord organizations.
Absolutely.
That would be useful.
Because I'd like to hear from the landlord organizations to give me some reason or at least some standards that they're looking for. I don't want to second guess what it is that they are, what their angst really truly is. And not just the mere fact that one has a, quote, felony he or she has on their record. It's one thing for us to have, quote, a facilitator, quote, unquote. But I think at some point we have to get as a society to really begin to get down to the heart of some of these issues. I liken to tell everybody, we've said as a society that once an individual has paid his or her debt, that then you come back and you become a part of this society. And I maintain that as long as you put the kind of barriers that we put in place, we're absolutely guaranteeing that people are going to go back. And so when we did 3194, it was with some of these conversations in mind that, if we're going to reduce recidivism, if we're going to have safe streets and safe communities, then we've got to make certain that we have things like housing and employment and some of these things so that people can be successful when they reentry and return back to their communities. And, everybody who goes in and come out has got a mom, a dad, a sister, kids, brothers, and they're part of who we are. And somehow we've forgotten that. And somehow we've got to do a much better job of trying to figure out how we're going to remove, quote, these barriers, quote, unquote, so that people honestly can come back and resume a life, a productive life. And that's why the good senator and I started this and said ban the box wasn't enough.
Right. And I can say, there's a lot of landlord associations that we should bring in. In our sort of over the past year and a half, what we've seen is issues around insurance. If you're not having screening criteria that bans certain felonies, your insurance goes up on a building. Issues around, if you have children in the building with sex offenders, that's a problem.
That's a whole different category on its own.
The issue of what we need to do with sex offenders and how we house them is something that we need to, I don't know if we can tackle it in this one, but that's a huge.
Personally, me, no one else will.
Yeah, it's a huge issue. So,
But I think from the basic generic piece, what the good senator and I are interested in, you mentioned insurance. And I'm sure that we didn't know that that's probably an impact, and we need to know what that is.
Yeah.
And maybe bring in DCB the other agency to begin having those discussions.
Yeah. No, that's it. And that's really the purpose of this work group is to kind of understand, to get beneath the surface of the problems and see, what's triggering this kind of response. And then the hard work of dealing with them one by one by one.
The only other thing I'd like to say is through this work, we developed a program. I think I mentioned it last time, like pre-entry. A lot of the folks we see coming out that have, the felony conviction, which is hindering them from applying for housing, also because of that felony conviction have, fines, have evictions on their records, have poor credit, which is getting people denied. I mean, I've had people go to apply, and I think, we're going to have to appeal the criminal conviction, and they get denied before we even get there because of the credit issue. And so I think, before people even go in, the Metropolitan Public Defenders are working with them to, say, this is a very stressful time, but what we need to do right now is make sure that sort of you're you work with your landlord to terminate your lease in a productive way. You, make sure you say to child support that you're going into prison, because all you need to do is tell them you're going to prison, and the sort of payments won't keep growing. But if you don't, there's no way for them to know that. And there's a whole host of other things, just sort of canceling credit cards, all of that, and those are key things because, once we start talking about barriers to housing, it's going to spiral because there's so many things going into why people are struggling.
Jeremy, the kind of established programs that are out there, like in Illinois you mentioned, what kind of success rate have they had?
In New York, the idea is also this kind of push-pull between forgiving and forgetting. So this is not sealing their record or not like my mind is going blank on the term for how you – when you get
– Expunged.
Yeah. It's not that. And so some people might say that it's better to expunge because then, no one can see it. This is more of an official sort of moving beyond point. In New York, I know that they're doing about 2,000 certificates a year. I do not know where the success rate is. I think because this program is so new, I have not seen any hard data on that, but that's definitely something I can look into. So,
yeah, I mean, it would be good to know because if we go down this road, and I'm very interested in our going down this road, we need to be able to show that this really makes a difference, or this is meaningful, right? And I guess a related question is, in those that you've done so far, how frequent is it that somebody's rejected by the panel? Does it ever
happen?
We
have very stringent criteria. So we have about a 50% acceptance rate. We do not, when someone is not issued a certificate, it is not a denial. It is these are the issues we need to work on. So if someone has an alcohol and drug, issue in their application, we need to see a comprehensive treatment plan. We need to see graduation from treatment, that kind of stuff. If mental health is an issue, we need to see a treatment plan around mental health. And so some of those things sometimes have to be bolstered. So I think what we found is folks that sort of successfully go through the program end up becoming stronger applicants just by doing the program because it's forcing them to go back and forth. We have had folks come who have had, they've been out 10 years. They have not engaged with social service agencies. They've worked a steady job, but now the rent is too high. They've got to move on. A lot of the way you guys have in the packet a successful application. The way we've been able to certify folks is via letters of reference from other social service agencies or jobs. So I think we struggle with folks that have been almost too successful that they haven't been engaging with other folks. So sort of finding a way to document.
Is that because of the whole housing issue in Portland?
Yeah, absolutely. Operating in a very specific context that's really...
It's a big one for Portland.
Yeah, it's... Housing is the number one issue right now in Portland. And it's affected sort of the numbers and
that
the success rate.
That don't want to cloud the rest of the state with
absolutely, rest. Yeah, yeah.
Multnomah County problem, particularly Portland problem. I do have a specific ask. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned on expungement and that there was a different word that's being used by New York. And maybe you or maybe Ron, maybe Mike, you can look it up. But what are the states, what is the length of time before that some states are using to expunge records?
I don't know.
And Mike, that may be a question for you, for CJC to do some research for us, because the question of expungement is not new to some discussion that we've had in this building. Yeah. So I'm sure other states are having conversation or have had conversation about the expungement of certain records, not all. But when you mentioned what New York is doing, but they don't call it expungement.
Well, so the certificate program is an expungement. So I don't know it much about expungements. That's not really my area. But the certificate does not take away the felony conviction from your history. So that it's a little different.
So Mike, can you do that for us? Can you research for me?
Yeah, Senator, what I'll do is I'll reach out to Chana Newell, who works as counsel for judiciary, because that's been a bill in judiciary several times.
I know
that Bill Taylor had worked on that extensively and put together a lot of research. So I bet you that might already even exist. So I'll email her right now see what's done.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Paul, and then we had a question over there. Or a comment.
Yeah, just a couple of comments. On expungement, generally speaking, it's difficult to get expungement for people who have multiple felony convictions. It's great for first-time offenders, but many of the people coming out of prison that we see here in Oregon have many convictions, and it's a cumbersome and expensive process. So that's just one comment. The other thing I would say about the certificates of rehabilitation is the Governor's Reentry Council a few years ago did some work on this issue, and I would invite Cindy Booth at some point to actually talk about that if we do decide to go down this road, because there's no sense reinventing the wheel, and I think it would be in our best interest to look at the work that's already been done.
That would be great.
Well, Paul, even if we start with the juvie system on expungement.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great thing. I'm just, saying it's not going to apply to a certain subset of the population.
In our specific program, we have we've had people apply with, 10 plus felonies. So I think that's one of the things that's very different about our program than the way other states are running it, because it's much more strict on that front. So.
It sounds like this certificate program might be beneficial to somebody who's not eligible for expungement, but would still need a little extra help.
Right.
But they're doing well, 15 years down the road, they still can't get an expungement, but they're still encountering barriers.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's definitely true.
Mm-hmm.
On the certificate, do you go through the same criteria as your Rentwell, where they're in a class for a day and then they're case management?
No. A lot of the folks that apply have the Rentwell component to show that they, are capable of being a good renter. I don't know. Is Rentwell outside of Multnomah County? I'm not 100% sure.
Yes, a lot of counties have.
Yeah. In Multnomah County, it's an excellent tool, and it teaches people how to be a good renter. In the way, sort of my 10-second elevator speech is this is like a reentry specific add-on to Rentwell, and it's not a class. Someone comes to me with the documentation, they fill out a very short application form where we collect sort of the data we need to run background checks and that kind of stuff, and then the majority of it is them attaching letters of support. And then it's brought to a panel who evaluate it. They read the panel, they read the applications beforehand, and then have a discussion about each application. So that's where things get a little dicey, because there's no guarantee that you will receive a certificate of good standing from us right off the bat. Something might not look right. So
you don't case manage them.
We do.
For a time after they get the certificate, do you still stick with them as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So we provide, if they're looking for housing, we provide case management. We check in with them on a regular basis to check in. Portland is very specific. So we had a couple of folks who have applied for the certificate in hopes of moving, and then with the rental market have decided not to move. So I haven't worked with them as closely. They certainly are eligible, from now until, Mercy Corps burns to the ground.
Who don't, the first time they try to get the certificate and they don't do it, will you work with them to help
absolutely.
Them achieve it?
That's where I sort of call them and say, could you come on in? We need to talk. And we sort of work to, I can send this out via email, but we had one gentleman apply with not a very strong application. And then we worked with him, and he eventually applied. He was chronically homeless. He received a certificate, and now he is, living in his own apartment. And I have, no doubt in my mind that the applying for the certificate helped him create sort of and helped him advocate for his success down the line, you know, with the landlord. So, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to tie together points made by Mike, Paul, and Jeremy. The ABA site that Mike spoke of, ABA stands for the American Bar Association. American Bar Association has identified over 46,000 individual collateral consequences federally. If you narrow it down to the jurisdiction of Oregon, it's a little over 1,200. Those are laws and administrative rulings that people with legal histories face. But the biggest barrier that they face isn't the laws and administrative rulings, it's your run-of-the-mill discrimination. Now, the study Paul spoke of, where statistical studies show that people who've stayed out of trouble for 5 years, 10 years, they're no more likely to offend than the average, you know, person on the street. I first became aware of that study in an article called 65 Million Need Not Apply. It's a really good article. You can Google it. It's mostly about the EEOA that Jeremy talked about, where more and more employers are being sued under Title VII for discrimination. And it's not only not fair, but it's not logical to hold these people who have legal histories way in their past against them. I've worked with lots of clients in their 60s who are still haunted by things they did at 18. And it's just stupid. I think what is really needed, in my humble opinion, is legislation like was enacted in the state of Washington in 1993. It puts limits on what credit reporting agencies and background check companies can report. It limits it to 10 years. If the employers and the landlords couldn't go back further than 10 years, it would be huge for the people who have those kind of issues.
Absolutely.
So I would really like to see that kind of legislation enacted in Oregon. They've had it on the books in Washington for 23 years, and the sky has not fallen. It hasn't hindered the ability of landlords and employers to operate profitably. So, that's...
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. That actually takes us into our last item, which is just to see if there are any legislative concepts out there that we should start working on. We talked earlier today about the driver's license issue. I think that's something I want us to pursue. I mentioned that Representative Frederick had a bill that had to do with fines and the interest on fines, and that didn't move forward. I'm not sure why it didn't move forward. We'll want to see about that, learn a little bit more about that. Julie, are you still on the phone? Okay, she may not be. Senator Winters, do you have anything that...
But before I talk about legislative, a couple things that I want to, because I want us to follow up on some of the housing things that happen that have to do with the renter side. But I also want us to take a look at some of the stuff through administrative rules. I'm very bothered that, you know, we as policymakers are just as guilty as those that we're trying to pass laws to get them to change for. And when someone mentioned what was that, administrative services and hiring and what have you, and I go back a lot of years, as you know. And I think we have to lead by example. And so, again, I want to start at our own house and see.
I am, and I'm sorry, one thing is slightly behind. Sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you, Julie.
So I'd like to begin to look at some of that and get some of those pieces to begin sorting through them, see if there's something that we can work on there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah. Well, we'll talk to the governor's people about that. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Hello.
She leaves. Yes. Yes. Julie, go ahead.
No.
Oh, sorry. Just so you know, there's like I'm listening on my computer. There's a delay on the computer about 2 minutes from what's on the phone. So that's why I'm still here. And I just caught it on the computer. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm still listening. Sorry.
Okay. So what I was asking is, do you have anything at this point legislatively, around these issues that you want to, put onto the agenda? Not that we necessarily need to go into it in depth today, but
sure.
I want us to start thinking about that because we want to have at least an initial group of proposals in time for pre-session filing in September.
Jen's true.
Yeah, so the things that I've been personally working on are really the driver's license issue, which we covered a lot today, the sort of earning back your life, if you will, on the professional licensure part, because there are some boards, I'm just going to be frank, that sometimes what I've heard from people is that, well, we just don't want those people coming in and being in our profession. And so, you know, some of the boards are better about waiving licensure than others. And I would almost like this personally, and that's totally open for discussion, but I'd like to put a little bit of that into a judge's hands in terms of saying, okay, this person, you know, really should get licensure. And because they, you know, they've really done what they needed to do to rehab. So the professional licensure is a piece for me. I think I've mentioned before, I'd like to see, you know, sort of that computer coding into our justice system. And the last sort of bigger hurdle, and I don't know if I'm going to have it ready for 17, is how do we take the same, you know, $36,000-$40,000 we're spending to house a prisoner and really use that last year for long-term folks and give them a softer landing coming out and sort of a prison without walls. I talked to Colette Peters about that a fair amount. And we know we've got some short-term transitional programs, but I'm looking at something even longer-term because what we know from sort of bringing people home from, like, war, for example, is you don't really hit the hard spot until after the 90 days, and most of our transition programs don't even get to 90 days. So what can we do post 90 days to keep people from reoffending? So that's kind of my area of focus that I'm really interested in and don't have completely fleshed out concepts other than the bills I had last year that didn't move out of committee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, even with a September deadline, that's, you know, some of this can be sort of conceptual. Right, we don't have to have all the details worked out.
I do think the proposals that Jen put on the table to talk about the trades, and I would like to see us, you know, to put some concepts around those. Mm-hmm. On the soft landing back, I would hope that as we do the justice reinvestment, that too, you know, we've got the person here because that is what that's designed for counties to begin doing some of that work. So
yeah, I should tell you for one of the items that will be on the agenda next time is I had a meeting yesterday with a couple of the universities. It turns out that university applicants are being asked about their conviction history. Actually, not just felonies, misdemeanors as well, the U of O is asking. And I hadn't realized that, and when I learned that, it troubled me, and so I met with them. And so they're going to come to the next meeting and try to explain why they think it's necessary to be asking that question up front. And so I'll send out the information that I received from them in terms of the application that's being asked. But as I understand it, it is something that none of the community colleges are asking that question, but a couple of the universities are, and there is a question related to that that's on what's called the Common School Application Form, which includes also private schools as well as public schools. So, you know, for me, initially, that's troubling. I want us to look into it and... you know, they argue that they're not rejecting people because of their history. And, you know, if that's the case, I wonder why ask the question? Because
my goal is that a housing issue because, you know, the universities do require sort of that first year on campus housing. You have to live on campus. Is it tied to housing?
That may be part of the rationale, but that it makes sense to me that that be a subsequent kind of issue after they've been admitted.
Sure.
And, you know, I just... You know, it bothers me that that's a question that's asked right at stage one. Yes, Paul.
So I'm part of a coalition of groups in Lane County that have been appealing the president's office to change the policy. And we've actually dug up quite a bit of research that shows that there is no basis for such policies. Not only do they ask about criminal histories, but they ask about behavior-ish school disciplinary histories, of which people of color are disproportionately impacted by, as well as criminal histories. So I think if you're going to have him present, I would love to be able to provide some additional information to the body to at least give a different viewpoint.
Okay, no, that would be great. And, you know, I think they will be coming to the next meeting. And it may be that hearing our concern is going to be enough to change the behavior, but it may require more than that. So
the
we'll
good
see.
Senator and I already reacted when we heard it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm glad that you did some research in there, Paul, because, to me, a lot of this is troubling. It's very easy to put laws, administrative books, administrative rules on things if you want to control. Whether you want to control populations, control people, and what have you. If you can also keep people from succeeding, you know, through all of these accesses and venues. And that's troubling to me. You know, the good senator know that we have so moved from the years of the 60s and 70s when things were a lot better, in my view, than we are in 2016. And supposedly, we're a lot more enlightened. Supposedly, we're a lot more diverse and forgiving and all of these wonderful things that we like to pat ourselves on the head about. And yet, we're sitting here talking about barriers to individuals that will disallow them to become law-abiding and a sustaining citizen. And that is the most troubling piece of all of this. And I think, if anything, and we're guided in this building by the greater the population out there. And one of the things, and we, through 3194, part of that is educating the public around us and these systems around us. That there's nothing to be afraid of. You know, and some of these, and I think we do have a tremendous job of educating our communities. And that's why I ask, where was the renters and all of this? Because, you know, we're living in a society of fear that we don't need to live in. I'm so glad that the good senator and I, you know, with working on Ban the Box, said, you know, we would undertake and continue some of these other discussions, because certainly if we don't begin talking about them, and we don't begin looking at how we can make, you know, whatever changes in them, I don't think that we're growing as a society in a positive direction. So,
yeah. No, I think that's great. And, this is an issue. So, you know, I know when you hear about government and you see most of government, you see that it's all about politics and people throwing things at each other. Senator Winters is a Republican. I'm a Democrat. We see eye to eye on this issue. This is an issue that really, I think, I won't say it transcends politics, but it should transcend politics. And but it's really critical that that we move forward on this. It's really great that you could all be here. We don't really have, we've kind of run out of time, but if anybody wants to make a quick comment about anything that you've heard or anything that you want us to be thinking about. You get the drift of what we're working on here, I think. Yeah.
Well, I think that my name is Joshua Laird, by the way, and I think that what Representative Parrish brought up about the soft landing for reinitiative, we have a great thing here in Marion County called the SOAR program. Not only is it a soft landing, but I personally went through that program almost 4 years ago, and I'm very successful. I'm graduating community college. I'm accepted into Corbin University. I have 5.5 years of sobriety. I'm a recovery mentor. But that program, it allows men, when they get out, to have transitional housing paid for by Marion County Parole and Probation. It gives them treatment for A&D and cognitive therapy as well. And then after that, there's aftercare. So it's not just 90 days and then you're done. There's aftercare, and it builds a rapport between the offender and the parole and probation, which statistically and throughout the past has never really been around. And I've been on active supervision since I was a minor, and I'm no longer on supervision, but I'm here with my old parole officer because she called and asked me, and there's nothing that I wouldn't do for her and what she's trying to do in our community, and that's never been a part of my life. And I'm not the only one that's here on behalf of the SOAR program and that reinvestment, but everybody's sitting here on this back row. And you know, I have my kids in my life, I'm married and have all of my kids in my life, and that's never been a true statement, and that's all because of this re-initiative, you know, you guys making policies and rules and laws and giving money to programs that help people like me, that gave me a second chance, you know. And the things with the 18 months, if I didn't have support like this when I got out, 18 months, I would have been probably 15 months already into another prison sentence. So I thank you guys deeply for your time and your guys' concern, especially when it comes to, you know, reinvesting into people like me.
Thank you very much.
Just so.
Hello, this is Julie.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Were you able to hear that, Julie?
The one thing I just wanted to, you know, generally comment, we talked about this, I think, at our very first meeting, and, you know, it's May. I'll just be honest, it's after the primary election. We're going into an election year. This is not an election issue. I fear I would love to have somebody come debate me about this in my own district. But, you know, I think one of the things that I think about is we think about some things that maybe push the envelope. If it's going to push people out of their comfort zone. And I just want us to be talking to members of our caucuses and certainly members of the media, and really be out selling the positive value, so that when we come back in you know, the next cycle, that people feel excited to take these votes, that they are comfortable taking these votes, that they do not fear taking these votes, because, of course, nobody wants to get sort of the tag with the soft on crime label, but, you know, we have got to do something to move the dial, and we can't be afraid of taking these votes. And I think the things that we're talking about are exciting, and I think that they're going to be impactful, and so we just have to, you know, make sure we're doing a lot of prep work, you know, with caucuses to say, hey, we all need to come together around these issues.
Great. That's a very good point. Thank you for that, Julie.
Very quickly, just because to the audience, because it's been talked about soft landings and what have you. We passed in several sessions ago, and you'll hear a lot about it because it's called 3194, and it was a joint bipartisan group of that met, and of course Mike now is continuing some of the work, and the work that he's doing is called Justice Reinvestment, and those dollars actually go to the various counties, and those counties throughout the state are to, you know, come up with innovative ways with which to use those dollars. In our county, I'm proud to say, because I'm part of Marion County, which is where your source program is at Chemeketa, and it started before that. But each county has those dollars to deal with in order to lower recidivism and to do whatever wraparound services that they deem applicable in their particular 36 counties. You need to know that, and I put that there because each county, none of us are the same. Multnomah County, I think, is doing some wonderful thing in that county because they're actually bringing all of their stakeholders, their parole and probation, and everybody in the courts together to do their planning before the person released. In our county, you know, we actually are doing some of the same. We're reaching into the system, into the prison, 120 days before. So I see that my parole and probation is checking her. We brought in the business community so we can look at the jobs piece. We have been talking to the housing people and what have you, because we recognize in Marion County, which I hope the other counties, that this is a county issue. This is a local community issue. And so we're trying, when we talk wraparound services and all of that, and trying to do everything we can that the person coming out can be successful and remain out. and that we lower that recidivism rate. But the person who has the purse string, that he will be coming and asking for more money, I know he will, this next session coming up on justice reinvestment. He's smiling when I said that. So anyway, but that's how we're set up currently in the system, to send dollars back down to the community for the communities then to come up with more innovative ways, not doing the same thing over that we've done in the past, but looking at ways to lower that recidivism and to wrap around. But I like what Jen is talking about, reaching in with trades before we ever get to that pipeline. So.
Thanks, Senator. Jim, did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, just one thing that came up in my mind. I've only been to a couple of meetings. Have we talked about the state being an example of hiring?
Yes,
we talked about that at the very first meeting, and we haven't pursued it, but we really need to.
Yeah, that was mine talking about administrative rules and the hiring. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If we could hear from DAS or somebody like that who kind of oversees the hiring processes, I'd love to see what we could do with that.
That sounds great.
Yes. With all the, like you touched on it, with all the justice reinvestment money now gone.
You mean allocated for this biennium?
Yes. I think it was $15 million for 13-15, and then like 36 or something for the 15-17. And you know, I would love to get together with you guys.
He's the guy. But you know, the best place to get together really is with your local folks.
And the Lipsticks.
Yeah. And the Lipsticks.
Oh yeah, I've already got them.
You know, well, if you've got them, because that's where the proposals are being made.
The missing piece to.
You know, I mean, that's where the proposals are being made. I just get a chance to sit and review what you guys are saying that you want.
Okay, you be the wolves. We'll throw them to you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, great. Well, I think we have exceeded our time. Oh, yes, please.
I just have one quick question.
Yeah.
I wasn't formally invited to this meeting today.
That's okay.
Plus one. But is this an open meeting? We can come back to it next month?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Absolutely. And we have a website, and this is technically called the...
We are in the Joint Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing, and if you're ever not able to make it to a meeting, we do stream it, so you can either watch it live or after the meeting's happened on our Oregon Legislative Information site. And if any of you have questions about that after the meeting, feel free to come talk to me.
Sure.
I also did the SOARS program, and I think what Senator touched on about the expungement would really help for the people that are, because we're limited on the fields that we can go into after all the schooling and stuff we're putting in. We're limited on the jobs and places that we can go in the community as for employment. So I think expungement would really be something to look for the long term, not just focusing on the short term or transitioning out, because we do have great programs for that in the community in all the counties. But that would open up doors for us that are trying to get back to the community in more areas, I think. So I like that. Thank you.
One other thing real quick. I know we're late, but I just wanted to make really clear that the legislation I spoke of wasn't specifically aimed at reentry. There was a small provision in it, like fifth on the list of things that were inserted into a bill that regulated the consumer reporting agencies. Now, consumer reporting agencies have been like the most hated industry in this country for decades, and there's something in that bill for everybody. I mean, seriously, it's an easy sell. And also, with expungements, in an ideal world, expungements would be a lot more accessible and easy to get, but you get a huge pushback from the judges and DAs on that. So I think that regulating the background checks is probably an easier avenue to pursue.
You know, and I'll make this, and I know we're live stream. We got tremendous pushback, not so much from the judges, but we did from certain, and not all DAs. When we first started the discussion on 3194, that was sentencing reform. And I think Julie said it well. Simply because it is doesn't mean that you're going to continue what you're doing and that you're not willing to look at and make some changes. One of the things that we've recognized in doing 3194, and I know some of you, I'm preaching to the choir, we can't continue to build more prisons than we do schools. We can't, and I think as a legislative body, you know, we had our backs up against the wall and said, you know, hey, you've got Junction City, Deer Ridge, and all this, and we're continuing to build, and the cost of building is a lot more expensive than it is to send people to Shemakata Community College and to higher ed. The other thing is that it's a waste of human capital. And so, you know, with that in mind, and Justice Jim Yunus was our original chair of the committee, and he later left, but you had a bipartisan group of legislators joining Justice Jim Yunus and others, and some NDA. I give a lot of credit to Underhill, who was from Multnomah County, and others that sat around, and we worked really, really, really hard to come up with the package that this body passed. So, you know, I think that this good senator and I, and the same was in Ban the Box, that they didn't give it a chance over on our side, did they? But we got it done. So I say that, that sometimes things might look like, or because it has been that way, I think that some of us believe that maybe it's time for us to look and tweak some of these things that were and begin to nibble. You know, Jen's thing of talking about trade, I think years ago, if you'd have talked about more trade in the institutions inside of OSB, you'd get that reaction, and you're not getting that. And so I'm hoping that people will see some of this a little different. At least I know my partner here is willing to have these conversations.
I think things are changing. We just need to nudge those changes along because it's for various reasons, I think we're potentially in a good place now, but this moment could pass very easily. And so, you know, we need to take advantage of the national conversation around being more sensible in the way that we are treating offenders and really, you know, push Oregon out to be a model state as far as this goes. So with that, I am going to bring this meeting to an end. Again, I want to really thank you all for coming, and you're always welcome. And you're always welcome. Thank you all for coming.